Introduction. Threads and the Body. The threads the Fates spin are so unchangeable that even if they decreed to someone a kingdom which at the moment belonged to another, and even if that other slew the man of destiny, to save himself from ever being deprived by him of his throne, nevertheless, the dead man would come to life again in order to fulfill the decree of the Fates. Flavius Philostratus, Life of Apollonius Tyana, 3rd century AD. The ancient Greeks believed human destiny was controlled by the Fates, three mythological sisters who visited every child soon after birth. Clotho, the most powerful, would take her spindle and spin the thread of their life. Lachesis carefully measured its length, and then Atropos would sever it, determining the exact moment of death. No human or god had the power to change their decisions once made. The Romans named their trio the Parcae, and the Norse had the Norns. This ancient story still echoes through the way we think about ourselves and our society. When we talk of lives hanging by a thread, being interwoven, or being part of the social fabric, or if we want to help someone in danger of unravelling, or being torn away from their friends or family, we are part of a tradition that stretches back many thousands of years. Fabric and its component parts have long been a figurative stand-in for the very stuff of human life. In many ways, this is only natural. The production of cloth and clothing has always been of great importance to the global economy and its cultures. Cloth gave humanity the ability to choose their own destiny. It's believed that prehistoric cloth making in temperate regions consumed more working hours than the making of pottery and food production combined. In ancient Egypt, linen was revered. Not only did it form part of most people's everyday experience, it was, after all, the most common textile used for clothing, and many people would be involved in farming and making it. It also held profound religious significance. So much so, in fact, that the very act of mummification and the wrapping of the body with specially prepared cloths, as well as those that had been passed down through generations, transfigured ordinary human remains into something divine. Our cavalier attitude to cloth today would be anathema to our ancestors. Textiles have allowed humans the ability to live in and travel through a plethora of regions that might otherwise have proved too cold to be hospitable. Rich silks and warm woolen cloths, bartered through trade networks such as the Silk Roads, facilitated cross-cultural exchanges of ideas, craft techniques, and people. The dexterous finger-plied work of producing thread and cloth was the daily experience of countless individuals. It has been estimated, for example, that over 1 million women and children were employed in spinning in England alone by the mid-18th century. On the eve of the Industrial Revolution, the income they earned might represent a third of a poorer household's income. This great economic shift, which in today's collective imagination is so closely bound up with steel and coal, was in fact largely powered by textiles, and of one kind in particular. "Whoever says industrial revolution," wrote Eric Hobsbawm in Industry and Empire, "says cotton." This crop, and the textiles made from it, was arguably the first global commodity. While we no longer pay as much attention to the sourcing and quality of the individual pieces of cloth that we interact with on a daily basis, they remain deeply personal. We use clothing, for example, to signal to those we meet who we are and how we want to be perceived. Distinct uniforms exist for those working in city hedge funds, Silicon Valley startups, and media companies, for example, even though most of these people will actually spend the majority of their days in offices and behind desks. Subordinates often adopt the sartorial preferences of their bosses, and trends spread like wildfire within the confines of small institutions. There was an inexplicable vogue for sleeveless sweaters in one office where I once worked, and the same professors who earnestly explained how futile it was to find meaning in the clothing choices of 18th-century ladies and gentlemen were usually clad in identikit tweed jackets and cord trousers, perhaps leavened with brightly coloured socks if they fancied themselves rebels. Social strata have long been codified, legally as well as unofficially, using cloth. Among the many strange prohibitions in the Old Testament, believers were enjoined not to sow thy field with mingled seed, neither shall a garment mingled of linen and woolen come upon thee. This wasn't a moral objection. Priests' garments were made of both, and this special combination was an honour reserved for them alone. Sumptuary laws that restrict the wearing of certain types of fabric to specific classes have existed for millennia. They can be found in cultures as diverse as those found in ancient China, classical Rome, and medieval Europe. A proclamation passed in England in 1579, for example, forbade ruffs made or wrought out of England, commonly called cutwork, to be worn by anyone, under the degree of a baron's son, a knight, and gentleman in ordinary office, attending upon Her Majesty's person. Queen Elizabeth I, the reigning monarch, was consummately skilled in the arts of using luxurious display to express power, as her portraits so elegantly attest, although it seems likely that she loved beautiful fabrics for their own sake, too. In a famous, although possibly apocryphal story, she was given a pair of knitted black silk stockings by her silkwoman, Mrs. Montague, in 1561, and refused to wear any other kind thereafter. Tools of the trade. I'm a weaver, a master weaver. I've got a loom where the best cloth's made. Plain cloth, twill, brocade or satin, I'm the master of my trade. Shed the warp and swing the shuttle, beat the reed, the weft is laid. I can wind a flying bobbin, I can walk a theme of thread. I can weave a sheet of linen, fit to grace a royal bed. Lift the heel and fly the shuttle, swing the reed, the weft is laid. English Folk Weaving Song. All textiles begin with a twist. The word spinning now evokes an idea similar to twirling, like the action of a spinning top, but it originally denoted an action that was at once a twirl and a drawing out, akin to pulling candy floss out around a stick at a fair. Much the same action is used when spinning thin, delicate fibres by hand to make thread, which is altogether tougher and more useful. Fibres of wool or flax or cotton, which are shorter, finer and more slippery, and so trickier to work with, are drawn out from a large, loose mass of their fellows and simultaneously twisted into yarn. This takes practice. Jerky movements will result in lumpy, clotted thread, while drawing out too quickly or too slowly will mean the finished product is either too thin or too thick. The twist can be either clockwise, in which case it is a Z-twist, or anti-clockwise, S-twist. But getting it just right is vital. Under-twisted yarn will be too weak, but if it is over-twisted, it will buckle up on itself and be prone to wayward knots and tangles as you work with it. Able spinners are the products of hours of repetition and, usually, instruction from a good teacher, who introduces the learner to the intricacies of the craft. There are many ways to spin, and the methods a spinner uses depend on their culture, personality, the kind of product they wish to create, and the materials they are using. Some twist fibres between hand and the big toe or thigh, others use a spindle, a rod usually around a foot long, even a hooked stick will do. Spindles give spinners an advantage, since they also provide a place on which to wind the thread as it is made, preventing it from getting knotted. The same community might use several different methods. Threads, once made, might be used as they are, or plied with other threads to create stronger, thicker ones, better suited to hardier tasks. Thread, once made, can be put to all manner of uses, braided or corded to make laces or ropes, knitted or, of course, woven. Weaving is essentially the process of interlacing sets of threads together to form a continuous web. Classically, two sets of threads are woven together at right angles. The warp is held on a loom to prevent an unholy muddle, while the weft threads are patiently threaded through. There are countless ways of intersecting the threads when weaving. The simplest form is plain or tabby weave, where each weft thread goes over one warp thread and under the next. More complex methods, where the weft goes over or under several warp threads, for example, can produce cloth with diverse characteristics or patterns. Twill, for example, used to make denim, is created by passing the weft threads over one and under two or more. The finished fabric appears scored by diagonal lines and is hard wearing. Given how finicky the processes involved are, and how soft, unruly, and fragile the raw materials, it's only natural that a whole dynasty of technologies has been developed to help in the production of cloth. Some, such as the spindle mentioned above, and the distaff, which was used to hold quantities of raw, unspun fibres, were allied to spinning. Others, such as the loom, were used for weaving. In essence, a loom is an implement used to hold the warp taut. One of the very earliest kinds, the backstrap, used the weight of a person's body to create tension. Another kind, common in ancient Greece, was known as the warp-weighted loom. It involved an upper horizontal bar from which the warp threads were suspended with weights at the bottom. No matter what the design, the weft is passed through from one side to the other, building up the fabric thread by thread. Later, more complicated loom designs allowed weavers to lift up some of the warp threads so the weft could be rapidly pushed through the gap, known as the shed, all in one go. The earliest use of this technology, known as the heddle loom, was in Egypt around 2000 BC. Much of the work that was needed to produce early thread and textiles is, of course, all but invisible today. The makers didn't often leave written records behind, and their techniques and skill have rotted away with the objects they created. What does survive leaves us with an asymmetrical impression. Someone using hand and thigh to spin will be invisible to the archaeological record, for example, while someone using a large stone spindle wall will not. The same is true of looms. The more complex and permanent they are, the more traces they leave behind. Clothing is the most obvious use for textiles, but threads and fabrics reside in many places we do not expect them. My boots are laced with jaunty braided strands of red cotton, and as I type this, my wrists occasionally bump against a suede-like material called Alcantara that covers my laptop keyboard and that is more usually found in high-end cars. If you own a Google Home, you may have noticed that portions of it are swathed in a comforting blend of polyester and nylon. Indeed, the designers of consumer electronics increasingly incorporate fabrics into their creations as a way of softening technology. Tech devices are now so much a part of our daily lives, it no longer makes sense to make them look hard-edged and futuristic. Instead, makers want them to blend into our surroundings. Just another cuddly component of our domestic landscape, hence the use of fabric. But the idea of softening tech products using fabric is itself inherently odd. The industry of fabric is older than pottery or metallurgy, and perhaps even than agriculture and stock breeding. Cloth is the original technology. Trade and technology. The weavers take the intertwined threads and through their expert, value-added activity, create a strong fabric, which is exactly what the global distributed network of computers creating the Bitcoin blockchain does. David Auburn, Weaving is a Better Metaphor for Bitcoin Instead of Mining, 2014. In 2015, Google I/O, one of the firm's secretive research and development divisions, announced that they were planning to make a pair of trousers that would also be computers. They would be made of a special textile, available in a wide palette of colors and myriad textures, that would function as a touchscreen, registering special gestures and able to control devices such as smartphones. 2 years later, it turned out that while the trousers had proved unworkable, Google I/O partnered with Levi Strauss to produce a denim jacket instead. The fabric itself functioned exactly as it was supposed to. The jacket, which can be tapped or stroked to play or pause music, skip through tracks and so on, and which will also alert you if you get a text, went on sale for $350. Although early reviews have found the technology rather limited, you're only controlling the smartphone that's in your pocket after all, others see such smart fabric as the wearable tech of the future. The name chosen for this futuristic endeavor was Project Jacquard, a name with a 19th century pedigree. In 1801, Joseph Marie Jacquard invented a loom that made it possible to mass produce textiles with complex woven patterns, something that previously had taken a great deal of skill, time, and expertise to produce. His Jacquard loom was controlled or programmed by pieces of card marked with a series of holes that determined the pattern. Much later, these ingenious hole-punched cards paved the way for another invention, computing. An American engineer repurposed the punched card system to help record census data. His firm eventually became part of International Business Machines, latterly known as IBM. The Jacquard loom is one of the more obvious links between technology and textiles, but examples can be found much further back. The earliest fabrics that we know were made by human hand were created using fibers gleaned from flax plants over 34,000 years ago. Transfiguring flax, wool, cotton, silk, hemp, or rami into thread was a technological feat, requiring skill and tools, spindles and distaffs, many millions of which have been excavated from the world's oldest archaeological sites. These threads could then be used to create rope, nets, and, when woven together on looms, felted or knitted, textiles. Such technologies allowed our early ancestors to gather food more quickly, transport it over greater distances and more easily, and venture further afield to less temperate regions to seek out new habitats. At every stage of production, these materials were traded by their makers, forming a vital part of networks that crept over the globe like arteries, carrying language and ideas as well as goods. This trade meant that sophisticated methods of credit and bookkeeping were developed. Making cloth meant making money. Wealth created by the production and sale of textiles funded the Italian Renaissance. The Medici family, who were involved in the production of woolens, became the bankers of Europe during the 15th century. Their patronage helped Michelangelo make his David. Filippo Brunelleschi rebuild the Basilica di San Lorenzo, and Leonardo da Vinci paint the Mona Lisa. Further east, cotton textiles powered the Mughal Empire. Calicoes were exported to America, Africa, Europe, and Japan. China, meanwhile, jealously guarded the secrets of sericulture, silkworm rearing, for many centuries, monopolizing the lucrative silk trade. Even today, the results of specialization persist. Italy is the place to go for fine silks and Baroque prints. Mantero, a 100-year-old firm based near Lake Como, has an archive of over 12,000 books of swatches and samples from which to draw inspiration. The United Kingdom's mills remain the gold standard for woolens and worsteds. Chanel sources its tweeds from Linton Tweeds, a relationship that dates back to the 1920s, when Coco Chanel met William Linton. For the latest in textile innovation, Buyers will usually begin and end their search in Japan, which has a decades-long tradition of successful innovations with man-made fibers, such as Uniqlo's beloved HeatTech range. The desire to produce cloth more efficiently provided the impetus for a jolting, uneven cascade of technological advancements. The earliest looms, requiring the weight of a human body, gave way to more complex horizontal or vertical models made of wood and weighted with large beads of clay or stone. Much later, as markets expanded and demand increased, the need for innovation became ever more urgent. In 1760, the Journal for the Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufactures and Commerce offered rewards for a machine for spinning 6 threads of wool, cotton, flax or silk at one time, and that will require but one person to work and attend it. They soon got their wish. Over the course of a century, the spinning jenny, the water frame and the power loom, and a host of other inventions, exponentially increased the rates of production. Think of the Industrial Revolution, and coal and steel will spring to mind. But it would be more accurate were we to picture instead the busy whir of threaded looms and cavernous factories choked with cotton dust. Indeed, even so fundamental an economic principle as division of labour had as a model the making of textiles. Nearly a century before Adam Smith conjured his hypothetical pin factory, the economist William Petty wrote that cloth must be cheaper made when one cards, another spins, another weaves, another draws, another dresses, another presses and packs, than when all the operations above mentioned were clumsily performed by the same hand. All this change had profound consequences for spinners and weavers. Take, for example, the plight of woolen cloth workers in Leeds in 1786, who suddenly found their livelihoods threatened by the invention of new scribbling machines, able to card the fibres more quickly and cheaply than they could. How are those men, they asked in a petition to a local newspaper, thus thrown out of employ to provide for their families? And what are they to put their children apprentice to, that the rising generation may have something to keep them at work, in order that they may not be like vagabonds strolling about in idleness? It was fears such as these that gave rise to the Luddite movement, a wave of violence against machinery by unemployed cloth workers. The term Luddite has since become derogatory, used to signify a techno-dinosaur vainly standing in the way of progress. Today, when the livelihoods of workers in diverse industries are similarly threatened by the development of new technologies, the lamentations of the Luddites feel all too relatable once more. Spinning tails. That must be wonderful cloth, thought the emperor. If I were to be dressed in a suit made of this cloth, I should be able to find out which men in my empire were unfit for their places, and I could distinguish the clever from the stupid. I must have this cloth woven for me without delay. And he gave a large sum of money to the swindlers in advance. Hans Christian Andersen, The Emperor's New Clothes, 1837. The threads spun by the fates were relentless. However much their subjects tried to avoid the future spun for them, they found that they could not. Oedipus's parents tried desperately to prevent the boy from murdering his father and marrying his mother, as had been foretold, but these events played out nevertheless. Likewise, wishes granted in stories often rebound horribly on the wisher. So it is with the Greek legend of King Midas. In the story, the king is so enamoured of wealth that he prays to the gods to make his mere touch enough to turn any object immediately to gold. His wish is duly granted. Not long thereafter, the king dies of starvation, unable to eat so much as a single grape without it turning to a gold nugget the moment it touches his lips. While this tale is familiar, less well known is the historical King Midas, the likely model for the myth. He ruled Phrygia, an ancient state in what is now Turkey, in the last decades of the 8th century BC. He makes an appearance in Greek historical records, but archaeological traces remain too. The Phrygian capital of Gordion was razed in the early 7th century BC, and its destruction was so swift that the city, and much of what was within it, burned where it stood. Excavations of the citadel turned up a great many things abandoned in the rush. One of the most extraordinary finds were over 2,000 loom weights discovered in neat rows within 100 metres of each other, lying where they had dropped as the flames consumed the cloth they hung from. Given this number, over 100 women must have been busily weaving cloth for the Phrygian ruler when the city was destroyed. No wonder, Elizabeth Barber Riley notes, the Greeks viewed Midas as synonymous with gold. Many other myths have thread at their heart. Think of Sleeping Beauty and her deadly spindle, or the malicious woodland sprite Rumpelstiltskin, who spins straw into gold. In another tale from the Grimm Brothers collection, a beautiful but lazy girl is saved from a life spent spinning when her husband, a king naturally, meets her aunts, each of whom possesses a deformity caused by a life spent working with thread, a swollen foot, an enlarged thumb, and a pendulous lip, respectively. Told by the clothmakers themselves, this story would have had even more resonance. It is no accident that the entire fabric of mythology and fairy tales is shot through with references to textiles and weaving. The work of making cloth was particularly conducive to storytelling. Groups of people, usually women, penned together and engaged in repetitive work for hours on end. How natural to create and exchange tales to pass the time. This also explains why spinning and weaving characters appear so frequently and are so often blessed with preternatural skills and guile. Take Penelope, the wife of Odysseus in Homer's Odyssey, who uses weaving to delay the impertinent Achaean suitors, who descend like locusts when they believe her husband to be dead. She set up a great web on the loom in her house and began to weave at it, a very fine thread and very wide, wrote Homer sometime around the end of the 8th century BC. In the daytime she would weave away at the great web, but at nights she would undo the work, with torches set by the loom. This stratagem apparently bought her 3 years' grace, indicative, perhaps, of just how little men understood this traditionally female craft. Women's work. And what did I amount to, once the official version gained ground? An edifying legend. A stick used to beat other women with. Why couldn't they be as considerate, as trustworthy, as all-suffering as I had been? That was the line they took. The singers, the yarn spinners. Don't follow my example, I want to scream in your ears. Yes, yours. Margaret Atwood, The Penelopeiad, 2005. Deities associated with spinning and weaving are almost exclusively female. Neith in pre-dynastic Egypt, Athena for the Greeks, Frigg for the Norse, the warlike Valkyries also wove, Holda in Germanic mythology, Mama Oklo in that of the Incas, and Tait, also spelt Tayet, in Mesopotamia during the Sumerian period. Amaterasu, the Japanese sun goddess, weaves, as does the weaver girl of Chinese mythology, but only when she is separated from her husband, the cowherd, by the Milky Way. Their separation was in fact engineered so that she wouldn't neglect her needlework. Stories of fierce fertility goddesses, nimble-fingered old crones, and vengeful maidens were sustained over the centuries by women. Unravelled and rewoven daily, like Penelope's tapestry, by countless retellings. Tales were spun, murmuring, to offspring in the dark, or recounted to companions as they sat and created cloth of their own. The making of thread and textiles, after all, has for centuries been seen as women's work. This is perhaps because it was the form of work most compatible with child-rearing. It could be done at home, with only half an eye, by those with experience, and could also usually be interrupted and resumed at will. Nevertheless, transfiguring fibres into thread was time-consuming and highly skilled work, performed by hand by many millions of women, up until the spread of mechanisation following the Industrial Revolution. Through this and other textile-related labour, such as the rearing of silkworms, women provided the materials essential for their families, paid taxes, which were at times demanded in the form of thread or finished cloth, and supplemented household incomes. In turn, the tools involved became irrevocably linked with womanhood. Many women were buried with their spindles and distaffs. In the Greek world, the birth of a baby girl was marked by placing a tuft of wool by the door of a family's house. Less concretely, the association made it into language too. In China, a popular proverb decreed that while men plough, women weave. The traditional English saying, the distaff side, refers to the maternal family, while the word spinster was, from the mid-16th century, used to refer to single women. The age-old kinship between women and cloth can be seen as both a blessing and a blight. In the Shi Jing, or Book of Odes, a selection of Chinese poems thought to date from between the 12th and 7th centuries BC, the care of silkworms and the use of their silk to create thread and fabric is approvingly spoken of as appropriate women's work. Many other societies, although not all, felt the same way. Men were involved in growing and reaping fibre crops such as hemp and flax, and the husbandry of sheep and goats. Children of both sexes would likely have helped too, perhaps by sorting wool or winding thread as it was spun. And in some cultures it was just as, or even more, common for men to weave. The Arthashastra, an Indian administrative treatise, the earliest portions of which date back to around the 3rd century BC, is strict on this point. Weaving shall be carried out by men. Women were permitted to spin, but even this was restricted rather grudgingly to widows, cripples, unmarried girls, women living independently, women working off their fines, mothers of prostitutes, old women servants of the king, and temple dancers whose services to a temple have ceased. In ancient Greece, by contrast, all women, from goddesses to queens and slaves, were involved in spinning or weaving. This, in the view of contemporary writers, was the natural order. Where the making of fabric was so strongly associated with women, it was seen as unlucky for men. Jacob Grimm recorded an old German superstition that if a man was out riding and came upon a woman spinning, then that is a very bad sign. He should turn around and take another way. Perhaps because of this, or because men were not usually as involved in the production of textiles, the end results have often been undervalued. Freud was certainly no help in this regard. It seems that women have made few contributions to the discoveries and inventions in the history of civilization, he wrote in a lecture on the topic of femininity. There is, however, one technique which they have invented, that of plaiting and weaving. He argued that these skills had been honed in response to a subconscious feeling of shame and genital deficiency, that women wove to hide their lack of penis from the male gaze. Such is the power of the idéfix. Accomplished spinners or needleworkers were an important, if often overlooked, part of the economy. Assyrian merchants in the second millennium, for example, frequently wrote to their female relatives about their cloth work, asking them to make a particular kind, for example, or letting them know what was selling well. Lamassée, the wife of one such merchant, responded, chiding her husband for making too many demands. "About the fact that I did not send you the textiles about which you wrote, your heart should not be angry. As the girl has become grown up, I had to make a pair of heavy textiles for placing or wearing on the wagon. Moreover, I made some for the members of the household and the children. Consequently, I did not manage to send you textiles. Whatever textiles I can manage, I will send you with later caravans." Working with textiles was largely indoor work that, it was hoped, would keep women occupied and out of trouble. But it could also be a source of justified pride. The Bayeux tapestry, to take one famous example, was likely designed and produced by English craftswomen to record the Norman victory over their own countrymen in the 11th century. Despite this, it is a work of great skill and beauty, recording around 50 scenes, graphic novel style, using only 8 colours of worsted and a length of tabby weave linen nearly 70 metres long. Centuries later, anonymous lacemakers created Baroque designs of dizzying complexity, each one requiring exacting, mathematical planning to ensure the correct numbers of bobbins were in play. Much more recent is the work of Sonia Delaunay, an abstract artist who created textiles in the first decades of the 20th century. One of her first pieces, made in 1911, was a blanket composed of bits of fabric like those I had seen in the houses of Russian peasants. The end result evoked the work of the Cubists. Her oeuvre included costumes for films, an interiors boutique, a Vogue cover, and hundreds of dazzling textiles so colourful that they almost hum with energy. 50 years later, working with her mother, Faith Ringgold began creating lush, storied quilts. These padded and stitched textiles, valued for their warmth and the canvas they provide for intricate decoration, date back to at least 3400 BC Egypt. Ringgold's work is now on display at museums including the Guggenheim and the Museum of Modern Art in New York. The consumption of fabrics was also gendered. In England in the 18th century, it was usual for women to buy fabrics and garments, such as linen shirts, for their family. Sarah Ardern, a married member of the lesser gentry in northern England in the late 18th century, spent a good deal of time and money on her husband's linens, as her account book reveals. She bought him muslin for cravats and handkerchiefs, and supervised the laundering of his linens. One entry in April 1745 reads, "Paid Mary Smith for making 10 fine Holland shirts for my dear lord." Supplying his wants was her largest expense, representing 36% of her annual expenditure. Just 9% went on the care of her 5 children. Needlework, spinning, and other textile skills provided women with a means of expression. "The needle is your writing brush," as Ding Pei, a famous female embroiderer, wrote in a treatise published in 1821. Spinning, lace making, sericulture, embroidery, and other textile-related crafts could give women economic power and status. In England in 1750, for example, spinning was the most common paid form of employment for women, and a relatively lucrative one at that. Single women were estimated at the time to be able to spin around 6 pounds of wool per week. A married woman would probably only be able to manage 2.5 pounds. Given the current rates offered, a spinster would therefore have been able to earn as much in a week as a skilled weaver, who were more usually men and were often in guilds, meaning their work was thought of as more valuable. It is only more recently that the word spinster has picked up negative connotations. Even if they could not expect equal remuneration, women could stave off absolute poverty if they possessed skill with a spindle, loom, or needle. This, for example, was the assumption behind the need for women to spin in the Arthashastra, Spinning shall be carried out by women, particularly those who were dependent on it for a living. Similarly, a law passed in Amsterdam in 1529 commanded all poor girls who are unable to do any lace work to report to a couple of locations in the city where they would be taught to ply a needle to earn their keep. Just over a century later, in the southern French city of Toulouse, the municipal dignitaries found so many poorer local women were engaged in lace production that there was a dearth of domestic servants. Here, too, a law was passed, this time forbidding lace making. Today, even though machinery and the expectation that production be done in factories during working hours have expunged the initial reasons that textiles became women's work, the association remains. In Bangladesh, some 4 million people are employed in the textile industry. 80% of them are women. Only a tiny fraction, just 150,000 in 2015, are represented by unions, with workers fearing reprisals from the mostly male factory bosses and political establishment. Garment exports accounted for 80% of the country's exports in 2014. Weaving words. He draweth out the thread of his verbosity, finer than the staple of his argument. William Shakespeare, Love's Labour's Lost, circa 1595. The words text and textile share a common ancestor, the Latin texere, to weave. Similarly, fabrica, something skillfully produced, birthed both fabric and fabricate. That language and cloth are so interwoven should not surprise us. They are, in some ways, intimately related. As one of the earliest technologies, fabrics played an important role in the material history of the written word. Paper was once made from discarded rags, and many texts have been wrapped and covered with textiles, both to protect them and to increase their value and worth. Bookbinders have long wielded needle and thread, and parallels can be drawn between calligraphy and lace-making. The relationship wasn't all one-sided, as samplers embroidered with homilies and fabrics decorated with symbols and words rich in metaphorical meanings illustrate. That the production of textiles was, up until the modern era, pervasive, strengthened the relationship. Children would have grown up seeing and helping their family members spin and weave. For poorer households, many of the textiles they used, clothing, sacking, furnishings and sheets, were the product of labour inside the home using raw materials harvested within a few miles. Tears, frayed hems and unravelling seams would have been darned, stitched up and re-sewn. Cloth was valuable and not to be discarded lightly. Makers would have told tales, gossiped and squabbled while they wove and sewed, so it was natural that terms common in the creation of textiles came so readily to hand in storytelling and rhetorical argument. These were lively, tactile images that almost every audience would readily understand. Today, the interface between text and textile has proven to be fertile ground for literary critics. They also unpick, fashion, piece together, or unravel, only their raw materials are more likely to be arguments, poems, characters, and plots. Similarly, wrapping and unwrapping have become vibrant themes in history and anthropology. Scholars, of course, aren't the only ones to use words rooted in textile crafts. You may have inherited a well-worn heirloom or two, or been on tenterhooks, spun a yarn, or privately thought someone's decoration looked a bit chintzy. The language of textiles is like the ticking of a clock in a room, inescapable once noticed. Many of these metaphors, however, are themselves becoming overstretched and threadbare, because most of us have very little experience or understanding of their original meanings. how much richer it must be to talk about weaving a coherent argument if you yourself have threaded a loom and flown a shuttle from one side of the warp to the other. Take the phrase tow-headed. Tow refers to pale gold flax fibres before they are spun, while being on tenterhooks comes from the frame, or tenter, on which woolen cloth is stretched out after being washed. If the vanishing of such expressions seems unlikely, you need only consider the fate of those that became baggy from repeated use or incomprehension decades ago. Few people today would refer to a knotty problem as a tangled skein, as Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes does more than once. Or use hatchel, an instrument for combing out the fibres of flax or hemp, as a synonym for harass or worry. Even being accused of talking fustian has lost its sting. Fustian, a type of coarse cloth often made from cotton, was hijacked to indicate inflated, turgid, or inappropriately lofty language. From language to fairy tales, technology and social relations, our lives are woven through with the threads of fabric production. The fates would likely have it no other way.